Accession number 19054, Reel 1.
John Tilston, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Hoylake, in the Wirral Peninsula.
Which year was this?
1921.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Hoylake?
Well, in the Wirral, near Hoylake, yes.
Whereabouts?
At Caldy.
What was the name of the school?
Caldy Grange Grammar School.
And how old were you when you finished there?
I was 18.
That would have been in 39?
It was, the end of 39.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did.
Under what circumstances?
On the radio.
At home?
At home.
And how did you feel about it?
I thought, oh gosh.
Were you dismayed?
No.
Did the war affect you at first in any way?
Well, it meant I left school prematurely. I left in December 39, where probably I would have gone on until June 40. And then I joined the Air Force, I think, in about March. But I don't know what went wrong. I joined in Liverpool, in the Central Hall, Liverpool. And then I joined up again in June and was called up in September.
And did you see anything of the Battle of Britain before September 1940?
No.
Why did you want to join the RAF?
I suppose the straight answer is I don't know. I suppose from what I'd read, Dunkirk probably made me think that wouldn't be a very nice place to be, and the circumstances didn't sound very good. But then you heard about sort of war heroes like Copper Kane and think, gosh, that's it, the Air Force.
So once you were called up, what happened to you then?
I was called up, I went to Babbacombe for just reception. Then I went to initial training wing in Cambridge. Went there probably end of September till end of November. Then I went to Brough near Hull for my elementary flying and started flying at the beginning of December. Then from there up to Montrose for service flying. And then when I got my wings, I didn't go to an OTU. I went to CFS to train as instructor. Then I think I started instructing about, I can't really remember, about July 41, perhaps a little bit sooner than that.
Why do you think you were selected as an instructor?
Well, I can only say one thing. We know we used to get assessments for flying, and my assessment at service school was above average, so I suppose that was it. Nobody, of course, wanted to be an instructor. It wasn't because we were brave, it was just because everybody wanted to go to a squadron. And I had, however you care to look at it, the good or the bad fortune to be assessed as a below average instructor, which meant that in due passage of time, I would have to take a recategorization test to see if I could continue as an instructor or was going to be hoofed off.
Why did everybody want to go to a squadron?
I just think it was the sort of the feeling of the day, you know. I think some people, I think I was one of them, vaguely left out, vaguely felt left out if we weren't instructing. And I suppose with the lure of the Spitfire, it certainly did have a lure, I don't think there's any doubt about it. But I went for my recategorization test at Uphaven, and I failed. So when I went back, the wing commander was rather cross with me, and I was a sergeant at the time, and said, well, Tilston, you'll spend the rest of the war towing gliders, which of course was the bottom of it. I'm not towing, rogue towing for at a gunnery school. And very shortly after that, I was posted to 52 OTU Aston Down, where I flew Spitfires. Then I went to 118 Squadron, Ribsley, the Ribsley wing. I was only there for a month. I hardly distinguished myself there. One of the first operational flights I ever did was at night, and I hadn't really done very much flying in the Spitfire at night. And we were scrambled. Normally what would happen, the young and experienced, I believe, were put on the first shift, as it were, at night. And before the other side started arriving with their bombs. But we'd only been on readiness a very, very short time, and we were scrambled. There were three pilots who'd been in the squadron some time. I can remember Brown, Jones, I can't remember the third, and myself, who were was the greenhorn. And they took off. Well, they took off. I took off last, being number four. And I lost them almost immediately. I could hear how we were being directed by ground control and followed their instructions, but I never caught up with them or indeed saw them. Fortunately, it was quite a nice moonlight night, so I wasn't spending my time flying in cloud, not knowing where I was. And I could see the coastline very, very clearly. And the raid was actually on Bristol. And then we were brought back to land. And again, due to my folly, I was coming into land. And I cut out the number one flying, I think it was Flying Officer Brown. He had to go around again. I don't think he was very pleased about that. Anyhow, a week later, or thereabouts, I went to 66 Squadron, which I enjoyed very much. We had an excellent CO, Squadron Leader Yule, a New Zealander. And I did a few ops with them. I think the most exciting was the raid on Dieppe. And then
can you describe the raid on Dieppe?
My squadron did two sorties, two 12 aircraft sorties during the day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, another in the morning one. And although we stayed together most of the time, we could see quite a bit of air action. The first time I'd ever seen an enemy aircraft shot down. It's a Dornier 17. Either 17 or 215, I can't remember. Then we came back and landed, and we could see sort of the melee on the ground. We weren't flying very high, I suppose about 8,000 to 10,000 feet, but I can't remember. Then the afternoon flight, we had two aircraft shot down. On the way back, Sergeant Loins and Lieutenant Nissen of the South African Air Force. Then we went back to Ibsley, and shortly after that, we moved to, which had runways, we then moved to Zeels, a little place near in Wiltshire.
Could I just interrupt you there and come back to the Dieppe raid? How much enemy opposition did you encounter on the Dieppe raid?
So far as my sortie was concerned, none.
And you said you could see the melee on the ground.
Well, when I say it's melee on the ground, you could see, I suppose, there were shell explosions or things, something. Not a lot, because you didn't really spend a lot of your time looking at the ground anyway. We were rather encouraged to look around to see what was above or behind us.
And once you had got into the Spitfire and started flying it on operations, what did you think to the plane?
I thought it was lovely. I remember once when I was at ITU, my flight commander, who was later my wing commander in the Middle East, am I allowed to swear?
Of course, yes.
Said, who's that who just landed like a bloody kangaroo? And that was me coming in bouncing. But once, they were a little bit sort of tedious to land when you first went, but once you got used to them, they were fine. Absolutely fine. Lovely to fly. Easy to fly.
Do you remember what mark of Spitfire this was at that time?
I did my actual training on sort of out of service ones and twos. And then in the squadron, the 66 and 118, we were flying fives, A's and B's.
And where is Ibsley?
Ibsley is just north of Bournemouth.
What was that like to operate from?
Great. Very good. There's the River Avon at the west side of it, which was quite a nice landmark. And once you were couple of thousand feet, you could almost see the coast of Bournemouth, so it was fine. I don't recall any particularly bad weather there, but I was there from, can't remember, about May 42 to August 42, and it was, I think if I remember right, it was a nice summer.
And what kind of facilities did they have at Ibsley for the aircrew?
Very good. We had dispersed messes and living quarters. Each squadron had its own dispersed. There were three squadrons there, 501, 118, and my own, 66. And they were very good. Entertainment, if you wanted entertainment, you had to go out, of course.
Where to?
We went to the local little village. There's a little pub there called The Crown. But we didn't actually do a lot of drinking, in spite of, you know, what one reads. I can't remember the name of the town. It was just south of Ibsley. Very nice little village.
Why did you not take so much alcohol? Was that for reasons of dedication or lack of money or what?
I think in my case, because I couldn't drink a lot. Often when the other people were drinking pints, I would be struggling through a half. It was just simply my capacity. No dedication or feeling that I shouldn't.
What was the discipline like in a squadron?
It was very good. We had a CO, as I say. It was a superb CO, and I had a very good flight commander, too. I never encountered any problems. I don't think anyone else did. And the air discipline was very good.
Because sometimes the picture is depicted of aircrew smashing things up. Horseplay.
That's certainly never been my experience. Well, certainly not in England.
And what was the character of the operations from Ibsley in general?
We did a lot of convoy patrols, and then one or two escorts. We did an escort of whirlwinds, one or two other things down to Channel Islands, and the odd sweep. I didn't do a lot of what you might call offensive operations. They were principally convoy controls and that kind of, or scrambles.
What did a sweep consist of?
Usually, well, it depended. It might just be your own squadron, but usually a wing. And it simply flew towards France and presumably looking for enemy aircraft. I don't know if there were any specific targets in the sweeps I was on. And occasionally you would have a Balbo, which was about six squadrons, and join up with another wing. But we flew in a rather archaic way then. I think this was 10 group. 11 group, I think, were flying in finger fours. We were still flying in three lines astern of four. And to be stuck as number two behind the CO in the middle line of four with two lines was not a terribly enviable position.
How did you like doing Balboas?
They were really just a sense of sweep. You didn't really see the other. Well, you might see another sort of 36 aircraft, anyway. I think we acted. I think if I look my logbook, I only did one Balbo.
Would you ever come across the enemy air force?
No. As I say, the only time I ever saw an enemy aircraft over the channel was on the Deer Parade. And that was only one. And it was already being engaged, in fact, already being shot down by other aircraft.
What was the opinion at that time in the summer of 1942 about the calibre of any particular enemy fighters which you might encounter? Were any particularly more regarded with apprehension than others?
Well, I think, if I remember rightly, the Focke-Wulf 190 was just coming in, but I'm not too sure about that, I don't remember. But there used to be a wing or a grupper operating from near Maupertuis in North Normandy, sticking up. And they had, it must have been a fighter ace, Captain someone, I can't remember his name now. And often when we were taking off, we had a bloke, Gooch Darby, who would all say, "Don't forget Captain Whatnot, chaps." But apart from that, I don't think. I mean, we were always told when we were briefed, be on the alert for this, and, you know, the usual routine, don't let the sun get behind you, and that kind of thing.
Why should you not let the sun get...
If an aircraft was coming from above to attack you from behind, it's very difficult to see in the sun.
And if... Did you think that you'd be able to cope with a Fokker Wolf if you came across one?
I don't suppose I ever thought of it. You would assume. I mean, obviously the idea was, gosh, I got one today. I've one idea, the other idea, I'm jolly glad he didn't get me. But I think the thing was, if you saw one, you'd obviously going to have a crack shooting it down. Yes.
Did pilots worry or brood over the possibility of being maimed or burnt or killed?
No, I don't think so. Though on one occasion, four aircraft went out. One of them was a squadron leader who was a supernumerary in the squadron. The other was a lieutenant from South Africa. And those two were very badly shot up. And you think, how awful. But I don't really think you really thought that could be me. I think if you'd have thought that, you'd have given up. Or you'd have been thrown off anyway, because it would have come out in the way you behaved.
Did that ever happen to anybody, to your personal knowledge?
It happened to a Canadian pilot I trained with, trained at Aston Danvers and OTU, and I met him again in the Middle East. And he went to a squadron, and he had no desire. And he eventually, I don't know how long he stayed in the squadron, the same wing as me, but he went back and became a military policeman. I lost touch with him. We all lost touch with him, whether they took his wings away from him or not. But that is the only case I ever came across.
He had no desire to fight in the squadron?
No.
And you were just about to tell me about moving to Zeals in Wiltshire, was it?
Yes, we moved to Zeals. I was there for about a month, I think.
Is this with 66 Squadron?
Yes, still with 66. We split up as a squadron. I don't know what happened to 501. I have a feeling they went to... I just don't know. They went to another place, somewhere near Salisbury. And I don't know what happened to 118. Our airfield was taken over by American P-38s. Which was rather nice to see coming in. We'd never seen them before in the flesh. And from Zeals, we did... one or two ops. We used to go down to I have to look the log. I can't remember these places where we used to go. We used to go to Warmwell, and we operate from there.
Warmwell.
Near Dorchester, which is a little nearer. And that was about it, really. I didn't do a lot with that. I wasn't there very long. When we moved to Zeals at the end of August, and I was posted overseas in the middle of September, so I only had about a month there.
Could you tell me about being posted overseas, please?
Yes. I went, had some leave, then I went up to Gourock, and we sailed out in the Empress of Bermuda to West Africa. I went ashore at Freetown for a little, and then we got onto a local Belgian coaster, where we went to Takoradi, the Ticeville, a little coaster to be remembered. It was absolutely appalling. I think we had two nights on that, and it was, the conditions were awful. And then at Takoradi, yeah, I had a few days there, picked up a Spitfire, and we flew that across to Egypt. Mostly Spitfires, a couple of Hurricanes, and we were led by a Blenheim. We made four or five landings in Nigeria, then Fort Laramie, as it was. I can't remember what it's called today, got a different name. Then across the Sudanese desert, up the Nile, which was quite an experience. I hadn't realised that the how the vegetation would stop and a desert would start, I expected to see it all merge in, and that was quite a surprise. And then we landed at Abu Swer. And from there, I went to that well-known and heartily disliked transit camp, Dalmaza, just outside Cairo. Then I did the usual, as all, I think most of us did, desert conversion course at Bala.
Excuse me, why was Al-Maza so disliked?
I think most transit camps were disliked.
Why? And
there was nothing to do, really. Messed around. We did unarmed combat and one or two other things. I can't remember how long I was there. All I remember from memory it was far too long. Then to El Bala, and from there I didn't go straight to a squadron. I got test job at 59 RSU, I think it was.
RSU, what does that mean?
Repair and Service Unit. Just when aircraft had been repaired or serviced, just flying them around and seeing that they flew and everything worked. Just Hurricanes and Spitfires. Then I, from there, at Castel Benito, just outside Tripoli, I joined 601 Squadron.
What kind of a squadron was this?
It was a fighter squadron, part of 244 Wing Desert Air Force.
And you said this was Castel Benito?
Castel Benito, yes.
What kind of a reception did you get at this unit?
Oh, very friendly. Very friendly.
And how did the leadership of this squadron compare with those you had experienced in England?
I found it perfectly good, perfectly good. My flight commander in New Zealand was an excellent bloke. Jerry Westenra.
Did you know anybody in the squadron?
Yes, I knew a bloke called Ibbotson, with whom I had done all my training, right to finishing service. He had been on Kitty Hawks before going on to Spitfires. He had quite a distinguished career. He shot down about 14 or 15 aircraft before he finally crashed and killed himself in Italy. But I think he was the only one, in fact, I'm sure he was the only one I knew. Later, I was joined by this friend of mine at Ibsley, and I got to know the others, of course, in time. But I only knew that one when I arrived there.
And what were conditions like at Castel Benito?
They were quite good. No problems at all. They got a little bit, as we moved further into desert, they became typical desert conditions, which were, you had slept in a tent, usually two or four in a tent, according to the kind of tent you had. You had a large, big tent, EPIPs, for your mess. We had common pilots' messes, though. We didn't have officers, NCO aircrew messes. I was still an NCO at that time. And it was fine. One of the things I think a lot of us liked about the desert, there were no artificial pleasures. You had to make all your own entertainment. So we played volleyball, kicked balls around, went swimming, played cards. It was really a very nice sociable life from that point of view. You were all dependent on each other for some kind of sort of pleasure or entertainment.
What were relationships like between members of the squadron?
Well, as far as I can remember, they were excellent. I never had any problems at all. I don't think anybody did. We just sort of knew each other. You were a team and you got on with it. And the leadership was good, which helped, of course.
And what mark of Spitfire did you have here?
Well, we had fives, and then a little later on, we had nines for a short period and then converted finally in Sicily to eights.
Was there much difference between these different marks?
There was a difference between the five and the eight and nine. The eight and nine had a, well, particularly eight. I only did a few hours on nines, but the eight was a lovely aeroplane to fly. It had more power, two-speed blower, which of course it gave you a little bit more power as you got higher. And It was just a delight. In fact, I think of all the Spitfires I flew, and I flew different marks after the war, it was the one I liked most. But the clipped wing fives, we had clipped wing fives. I think the idea of clipping them is, of course, they'd have a roll rate the same as the Messerschmitt 109. They were nice. They were very manoeuvrable little aircraft.
And what kind of operations were the squadron doing when you joined it?
They were principally doing, I suppose, air defence, scrambles, or set shows if something was coming in, and beginning to do more strafing. Whether they had done strafing before I joined, I don't really know. I think they were principally air defence and offence in the air.
What was the Spitfire like as a plane fitted for strafing?
I thought it was all right. Actually, I didn't do any strafing in Africa. I didn't do any strafing. It was Sicily and Italy. In fact, I'm not even sure I did any strafing in Sicily. Certainly in Italy. I don't recall having done any in North Africa.
And what did the enemy opposition amount to at first when you joined the squadron in February 43?
All I can say is at first, exceptionally strong. I was shot down in my first operation.
What happened?
We had moved up to a place from the Castellaneta called Ben Gaddan, which was a ghastly place to land for the simple reason the sand was so thick. Normally the desert was very nice and hard for landing, but this was pretty thick. And we're moving up to a place, a strip called Hasboob. Now in those days, if you boobed, you made a mistake. And Hasboob was a mistake. As we moved up, we were shelled off it and had to move back to Ben Gaddan. The next morning, four of us went up forward base just for on readiness. And we were scrambled. I was being led by a Canadian flying officer, and we were just flying up, and suddenly I heard a bang, and that's it.
Okay. Don't attempt to get up, please. No, just tell me in words and we'll look at it.
And then I saw this Messerschmitt 109 come past me. By this time my engine was coming out. We were at about 20,000 feet, glycol, and I did the silliest thing. I turned away from it. Now, if he'd have come back, I mean, he'd have been in a beautiful position behind me, but he didn't. And then he hit my leader. Percy was quite nastily injured in the leg, but his aircraft wasn't damaged. Mine was damaged. And at about 3,000 feet, by which time the glycol temperature was off the clock and it was black smoke was zooming, I jumped out, landed. I'm not exactly sure where I landed, more nearer to our side than the other side. And it seemed as though I was there a long time, probably about 5 or 10 minutes, and a jeep of the 1st Indian Div came and picked me up.
Were you injured at all?
For all practical purposes, no. I just had a little bit of explosive bullet in my left leg. I hadn't even felt it. In fact, until the doc said you've got blood on your slacks, I didn't even know. So, no.
Didn't it incapacitate you in any way?
No, as I say, I didn't.